like to talk to you about an article that is included in one of my favorite collections of Rav Lichtenstein's Machshava, which is a book called By His Light. Now, you'll see on the source sheet that we're going to be doing some of the primary sources, but we'll also be, specifically, I wanted to give you access to the write-up of Rav Lichtenstein's essay itself. Now, I just want to make note that this is the original copy that I used to prepare this year. This was the first version of it when it came out. I believe it has since been republished in a hardback version with a different cover. I don't know if the pages are the same or not. So if you ever go and looking for the original essay, because this chug is so scintillating and interests you so much that you want to read the original, which I would hope. So if it turns out that it's the wrong pages, so I apologize in advance. But if you get the original paperback version, so then the pages that I list here are all accurate. I don't know. It could be that in the hardback the pages are the same. I'm just not sure. But I used the copy that I had at home. Anyway, so this is an essay called The Centrality of Torah Study. Now, I know that a lot of people are interested. In fact, I think I've even had some conversations with people specifically about the question of Gemara. Why is that so central? So Rav Lichtenstein actually addresses that, but not in this essay. This is not what we're going to be discussing at all. What he discusses is something actually much more fundamental, which is what is the role of Torah study in the life of a Jew? Please take some source sheet. Please take. Enjoy. So what is the role of Torah study supposed to be in the life of a Jew? And the basis of the entire essay is one little phrase in Pirkei Avot, source number one, Shammai Omer, Asei Torascha Keva. Make your learning keva. Anyone who wants to translate the word keva for me? Permanent. What else?
Fixed. Consistent.
Correct. Fixed, special. I think they're all good translations. And in fact, because keva is not usually a descriptive term that we would expect with something like Torah study, so in fact, as we'll see momentarily, the various commentaries, the Mefarshim on Pirkei Avos, are going to give different explanations. But what I want, just before we do anything, maybe if I remember, I'll say this at the end of this year, but just in case I forget, let me mention right now. Above and beyond everything else, you will see one element of Rav Lichtenstein's brilliance, which is that he could have an entire essay with various layers and aspects of meaning based on one little phrase in Pirkei Avos. I've read this Mishnah 100 times, but what we're about to see that Rav Lichtenstein did with the Mishnah, so I have to be honest with you, it never would have dawned on me. So in and of itself, it's already like quite remarkable. You know, it's one thing when you have a multi-layered, complex Gemara. Okay, so then you bring to bear somebody's like Rav Lichtenstein on that. When the end product is a symphony, it's not a shock. But when you take something this simplistic, ostensibly, so straightforward, one little phrase, Asei Torah Sakeva, and you can turn that into a symphony, that, my friends, is already a sign of greatness. So let's take a look at what the Mefarshim say, and we'll see how Rav Lichtenstein teased out an entire Weltanschauung, if you prefer German, Hashkafas Achayim, a whole perspective of life on the role of Torah study in life of the Jew, just based on the way the Mefarshim understand this little phrase. Who do we look at first? Naturally, Rashi. Take a look, Rashi, at the second source. Rashi says, two perushim. The first thing says Rashi, shelo tehei kovea itim latorah. Whoa! Don't be kovea itim latorah. You stop there, it would be like shocking. You shouldn't have set times to learn Torah? What does that mean? So Rashi continues, ela kol hayom te'asena alecha keva. So how does Rashi understand keva in this first explanation? Permanent, all-encompassing, right? Having a set time for a chavruta is a double-edged sword, says Rashi. On the one hand, you've dedicated this time to Torah, but by implication, what have you then said? Not the other times. Says Rashi, don't put Torah in a box. Don't limit Torah to a specific part of your day. Make it pervasive, all-encompassing. First explanation. Then says Rashi, a second pshat, second line, tikav lecha itim lilmod b'chol yom, you should set for yourself specific times every day to learn. Dalid prakim ohei. 4 or 5 chapters. Mishnah, Gemara, whatever, something. Tanakh, Parsha. 2 pshatim. Now, aside from the fact that it's 2 pshatim, If you would ask me, when I first read this Rashi at first glance, what does the relationship between these two explanations seem to be? What does it seem to be? Yeah, not only different, if you'd ask me right off the bat, I'd say almost opposite. The first one is don't limit Torah to a specific time. The second one is not only is it limiting Torah to a specific time, it seems to be kind of limiting it to a specific amount. Now, clearly Rashi is not schizophrenic, so we know that we have to dig a little deeper. So Rav Lichtenstein does the heavy lifting for us. If you take a look, what does he say? Very beautifully. I'll read parts literally inside word for word, and other parts I'll paraphrase. But even when I paraphrase, it's good you have it in front of you. Said Rav Lichtenstein, listen, what are we talking about? This is his first insight. He says, we're not talking about a full-time learner. We're not talking about someone who spends his entire day, or even most of it, learning. Rather, in terms of his attitude, his desire, he makes Torah primary. This is the sense of Rashi in his first interpretation. Do not set aside times for Torah like you would set aside times for tennis. I love that line. You could substitute cricket or football or basketball or mahjong or I don't know whatever else people do for hobbies. So says Rav Lichtenstein, what are we talking about? We're not talking about somebody who can learn 24 hours a day or even 12 or 15. But the first thing Rashi is telling us, what is your attitude supposed to be? Torah is not a hobby you schedule into your busy day. It's a spirit that you have that even if you can't learn all day, you wish you could. It's attitudinal. Then he continues, Rav Lichtenstein says so beautifully, he says the second explanation of Rashi is not a contradiction, it's a compliment. Because if all you think about is this abstract thirst for learning, this desire, I wish I could learn all day. I remember those years I was in Gush and I was in the yeshiva all day, and now I'm back in college or I'm uni or I'm, you know, working in the law firm or in the hospital and I'm thirsting, I'm wishing. So it looks like that's not enough. That's important, but it's not enough. So that's the second shot in Rashi. Even though a person may thirst for Torah, this longing still needs to be translated into practical terms. And therefore the second element is, while there's never an upper limit on Torah, we never say, okay, I've reached it, that's all I need, that's the ceiling, that's the maximum. Ain't the markazet. There's no such thing as an upper limit. But, says Rav Lichtenstein, you see from Rashi, it is important to have a bottom, a lower limit of your learning. Surely you cannot make do. There has to be something in your life that you know yourself, and I would say, I think this is clearly what Rav Lichtenstein is implying, that the examples of Rashi are just examples. Content or the quantity, but in your life, your interests, your abilities, your time, a certain minimum you could commit to and say, this is the minimum. It's one thing to have the thirst and the all-encompassing desire for more, but you can't leave it at that. You have to also be practical. And there has to be a certain commitment, says Rashi, the basic level, I'm not going to do any less than that. If you look at the last two lines of Rav Lichtenstein, he sums it up very beautifully. Rashi's two explanations do not contradict each other. The latter gives you a minimal, real, practical framework. And the former, the first one, gives you a direction, a thirst, a longing, without setting any kind of upper limit. So does everyone understand now under this interpretation of Rashi? The two explanations are actually working hand in glove. The first explanation sets the tone. The very fact that there is no such thing as an upper limit. We're always thirsting for more. We never say, must speak enough. But mitzad sheni, on the other hand, we can't live in the clouds. There also has to be a practical regimen. Okay, so now I'm in college. I'm in university. I am in the law firm. I'm in the hospital working. But maybe for you it's daf yomi. Maybe for you it's nach yomi. Mishne yomi. Shnayim mikra vecha targum. Something. Or you just take Rashi literally. Four or five somethings. Or if I have psukim, or if I have mishnayo, or whatever it is. But you take something, you say, barring a disaster, this is something that I'm going to do. Now, I gave the example, by the way, of dafyomi, just because it's such a good example. And because, you know, three summers ago, I personally started dafyomi. And I could, even though I was never a dafyomi Jew, it was not my style of learning, I prefer much more bi'iyun, I'm never such a dafyomi guy. I started 3 years ago, and I can fully vouch for the limitations of daf yomi, frankly, but I can definitely vouch for the benefits of daf yomi. and probably the single biggest benefit, in my opinion, is this Pshat and Rashi. That no matter what I know, I got to learn the daf. Doesn't matter how busy I am. And again, I don't think the person 3 years ago was such a bad guy. I don't think the person I was 3 years ago was such a batlan or an am aretz. I used to learn a lot then too. I didn't have dafyomi. But there were times, busy days, other things, or maybe I didn't have as much time to learn. Or maybe I did other things but not Gemara. The idea that every single day I have to learn Gemara, and it doesn't matter if it's Yom Kippur, during the break, after fasting a whole day on Tisha B'Av when you can't learn, or any other day where I'm busy. So that's the spirit, which is definitely even impacting and elevated my life. That's the minimum. That's the second thing of Rashi. So no one would say that the dream and the be-all and end-all of life is Dafyomi. But as a bottom limit, it is quite elevated. Commits us day in, day out to a certain regimen. And everyone can do Dafyomi. So do Amud Yomi, do Mishnah Yomi, Mishabur Yomi, Nach Yomi. The idea of having a Yomi, a minimum Kvius, that becomes a central part of your life. So I will think that's the idea of Rashi. Any questions on Rashi? We're good? So Rav Lichtenstein points out that the Rambam says something similar. For the sake of time, we'll just paraphrase it. But the Rambam there says in the Perish HaMishnayos, in his commentary, basically, make Talmud Torah the main part of your life, the Ikar, and anything else, Zulato Me'iskecha Ba'acharav, anything else, that comes secondary. And as the Rambam says, so in a pithy way, where it's underlined, im his damein, vim lo his damein, in nezek. If you have time for the other things, good. And if not, the world's not going to fall apart. The sky's not going to come crumbling down. In other words, make Torah the one thing you can't live without. You have to work. Okay, so you'll work. But that's it. But if you can't go into work one day, then you can't go into work. But there's no such thing as I can't learn. That minimum, that connection to learning, has to be primary. And as Rav Lichtenstein summarizes in the next paragraph, says, you're a professional, so of course you have to work. But nevertheless, it's a question of how a person defines his professional and his economic goals. This is actually reminiscent of something that I once heard from Rav Lichtenstein's nephew, Rav Meir Tursky, one of their Beim, Rosh Hashiva at YU. I remember saying years ago, of course a person has to work to earn a living, but how much do you have to earn? So certain people think, well, I have no time to learn because I have to work 12 hours a day. Well, why do you have to work so long? Well, because I have to make, I'm just making up a number. I hope everyone agrees that this is a little bit obscene as a, I have to make $1 million a year. Why do you have to make so much money? Well, I need a house this big. I do need this many cars that cost this much. I have to take the family away to a fancy hotel for Pesach. I have to take them away for, you know, winter vacation, all of it. So if a person has all these extraordinary things which he feels he has to do, well, therefore I have to work 20 hours a week, 20 hours a day, and therefore I have to. So says Rav Lichtenstein, says it beautifully, that those decisions also reflect priorities. Right? Saying an acknowledgement, a person has to work, you know, as we'll see in a little bit, in two sources, the Rush says, Derech Eretz, earning a living, is also a mitzvah. But again, that can be manipulated. I think if we're being honest, we all know that, right? Right. Who determines how much you have to work? How much? Right? That's always going to be subjective. So, how much we have to work, and does that leave us time for learning? That decision we make. Plus, at the end of the day, let's be frank. Everyone has free time. Some people have more. People have less. Right? But everyone has some level of free time. And I didn't put it on the sheet, but Lucy makes the point. It's okay. You have to work. I got it. But when you come home from work, what do? The answer is maybe I have to talk to my children, talk to my wife, play with my kids, toss around a ball. Okay. And then what? So the answer is maybe then I go to sleep because I have no other time. Okay. No complaints. But what if you have extra time? What if you have free time? So what do? Okay. Everyone has to decide that. So that's, according to this approach, that's a say teres hakeva. That, on a practical level, a minimum, and a more overarching level, Torah has to be part of my everyday life. It's not a question of whether I'm going to spend the rest of my life in yeshiva or I'm going to spend the rest of my life in a bank. It's not that that's an unimportant question. It's a very important question for each of you when you figure out your life. But that's not the point of this mishnah, says Rav Lichtenstein, or the point of this essay. Whatever you end up doing, Torah can be the primary. It's the one unmovable object in your life. And Rav Lichtenstein points out that if you take this attitude, that has halachic ramifications as well. It creates a certain status which will devolve on each and every one of us. What's the status? So he quotes from the famous Gemara, maybe you're familiar with it, the Gemara Baba Basra and Dav Zion, which tells us when a city is levying municipal taxes, and the city has to decide how much to pay. So everyone uses the roadblocks, the roads, everyone has to use the well or whatever else you would need. But what's one of the other things they used to tax people for? Civil defense. In the old days, it was a wall around the city. Nowadays, we call it a police force, an army, whatever. So the Gemara there has a famous line, Baba Basra, Rabbanan lo tzrichini tirusa. The rabbis in the community don't have to pay the taxes towards the defense of the city. But somehow there's some mystical protection, they don't need it. Okay? It's a little bit of a controversial or interesting idea. As you can well imagine, it's often bandied about in the contemporary discussion of yeshiva guys going to the Israeli army. We're not discussing that. That's not our topic. But what is relevant to us is the way the Rosh understands that Gemara. Again, imagine we're still in some old Talmudic time city that had a wall for defense. And the Gemara says that even if the rabbis have to pay other taxes, they don't have to pay the tax for the defense of the city. Well, which kind of rabbis? Any guy who has a piece of paper says, I'm a rabbi, he's a rabbi. Nowadays, she's a rabbi. I mean, who are we talking about? Who counts for this? Says the Rosh, the next source, Dafka Tamar Chacham Shetorasa Umanasa. You ever heard that phrase before? Torasa Umanasa? Mm-hmm. How do you translate it loosely? Torah is your profession. That's really probably even a literal translation. So in your mind, and frankly the way it's often used in contemporary discourse, what kind of person is described as someone who's Torasa Umanasa? What kind of person? Who's it describing? Everybody?
If you want to look at it that way.
Who is the kind of person about whom you can say Torah is their profession? Torah is their...
Teachers.
Okay, a teacher. What else?
What else? You.
So, don't give me a... maybe I wasn't fair in my question. Maybe I wasn't clear. I'm not asking for a job title. So you could talk about getting paid. Or I'll say more broadly, someone whose entire life is dedicated to Torah. Right now, maybe that does he have to learn 24 hours a day? Maybe we'll be making one. I'm only 23 hours a day, But I think we're in agreement that the simple understanding, the way we often would have would imagine, or frankly, many of us maybe even have heard the phrase, that's what it would imply, right? So the Rosh disagrees, and it's important to note, even though I didn't put it on the sheet, that the Rosh's definition is quoted in Shulchan Aruch. So it's not just an explanation; it is the correct explanation halachically. Says the Rosh, now Lichtenstein quotes the Rosh of Baba Basra. I quoted for you on the bottom, just if you want to look at it for yourself, a more expansive elaboration by the Rosh himself in a tshuva. But it's not a contradiction, it just says the same thing more expansively. Says the Rosh there in Baba Basra, what is Torasa Umnasan at the end of the first line? Tamar Chacham Sheish Lo Umnus. No! I'm not talking about a guy who learns 24 hours a day, or even necessarily is a rabbi or a mechanech. Those are all good guesses, by the way, but that's not what the Rosh says. Says the Rosh, I'm talking about a guy who's also a cobbler, or maybe an accountant, or maybe he's a doctor, or maybe he's an Indian chief. He has some other profession. Oktas masu matan, he's a businessman. He's parnes kidei chayav. He works in order to basically make a living. Adds the Rosh, very importantly, v'lo lihit asher. He doesn't work to get rich. Again, the example I gave before. Guys, I would learn, but I have to work. Oh, yeah, but working is a mitzvah. I have to work 20 hours a day because I need $1 million. Says that, no, that's not Torah Sur Masa. Torah Sur Masa is a person who's working for the minimum that it takes to live. I have to live, I gotta work. That's for my children, I gotta work. But I'm not trying to get rich per se. Ubachal Shash Upanui. What's the litmus test? How do we know what's really in his heart? Show me what he does in his free time. Says the Rosh. Kal Shash Upanui mi isko, machazer al divrei Torah, velomi divrei Torah. Any free moment he has, he wants to learn. Zeo shenikra torasa numnasa. Now, what does that mean? Free? I have to spend time with my wife. Fair. I got to spend time with my kids. I have to work, and I have to sleep, and I have to eat, I have to daven. All true. But there's still something left over. What do you do with that? If a person dedicates that free time to learning, says the Rosh, you are someone about whom could say, Torasa Namasa, which is like the highest kind of a compliment. To the point, if we were discussing municipal taxes, which we're not, we might even get a discount. So, getting back to where we started from, says Rav Lichtenstein, this is the notion that Rashi and the Rambam are describing on Keva. A kind of person for whom Torah, even in its most minimum, is an immovable force in his life. This is the anchor. This is the axis around which his life spins. Okay, you with me? This is very, very important, guys. Because again, statistically, if I had to assume, there are people in this room who are going to walk out and eventually become big rabbanim. But it's probably true that at least a large percentage, if not most of you, are going to end up being great people who do other things. So people sometimes make a mistake. Well, those are my Torah years, my yeshiva years. You know, I was in the Beis Medrash, Baruch Hashem. Some people never do that. I was. Some people are only in a certain kind of Beis Medrash. I was very fortunate. I got to be in Gush. Oh, it's wonderful. Baruch Hashem. But now I do other stuff. That is a catastrophic mistake. That is not the mentality. Says Rashi, says the Rambam, says Rosh. Torah Sakeva means Torah is a central part of your life. Not that it's unimportant how much you learn. Of course it's important. The more you can learn, the better. But it's a secondary question. It's a secondary question. The more primary question is, what is your mentality? What role in the hierarchy of values does Torah have in your life? You see, as Rav Lichtenstein says in that next paragraph in English, when he has a free hour, he devotes it to Torah. When he has a vacation, he brings it to learn Torah. Torosa umnoso is his natural self realizing itself. When he's at work and he cannot learn, he's in a certain sense suppressing his natural self. And I can tell you, gentlemen, I'm a rabbi. I get to do this on the cheap. I'm lucky. I get to do this full, you know, professionally. But I know people who I have insane respect for, doctors, lawyers, other business people, who are exactly like this. It's like, not that they don't value the work that they do, they're doing sometimes very valuable things. But you get the sense, very clearly, without them boasting, if you know them, you know this about them. They really wish they could be learning more. And everything they're free, they are trying to learn. Their life is the learning. The other thing is the profession. Now, you all know, there are plenty of other people who are not like that. Their life is the profession, but their life is the pursuit of money. They might be strictly observant. They go to shul. Maybe they do daf yomi. It's a mentality. There's value, and that's how you apply the application of the value. The application not only can, it necessarily will vary from person to person, because everyone's circumstances are different. But the value should be the same across the board. Yes, Austin.
So a person, two people who do the exact same, have the exact same schedule, why does it matter if one has, or practically, why does it matter if one has this mentality and one doesn't?
Well, Rav Lichtenstein would say, not only does it matter, it's everything. Because what is really the measure of the man is not just, again, I want to be careful how I say this, it's not just what's in your heart. We're not a religion like that. It's not just about having good intentions. We do have things that we have concretely must perform. That's for sure true. I think you know that, needless to say. In Judaism generally, and halacha particularly. But, at the end of the day, as the Gemara says in a different context, Rachmana, Libavoy. What Hashem really wants is your heart, is the commitment. Now that's not instead, Austin. Of course it's not instead of the mitzvos. I didn't daven, but I'm really thinking about daven. That's absurd. But what it means is, when you do the mitzvos, the true measure is how much of your heart, how much of yourself do you put into it. So, first of all, two people who are doing, as you said in your example, Austin, two people are doing the exact same thing. They're both shaking the lulav, they're both learning 2 hours a day, the same thing. So again, yes, some person has one mentality, another person has a different mentality. I think that absolutely makes a difference. But secondly, and this is the point I was making, which... even if you have people, I'll take what you said, Austin, but I'll raise the stakes. Let's say you have the guy learning 2 hours a day, but by him, that's like a casual hobby kind of thing. And, you know, most days, he's very fortunate. He has an easy work schedule. Maybe he's, I don't know, independently wealthy. So he can do it easy come, easy go. Just most of the time it goes. Most of the time it's there. You have another guy who has to scrape and work 10 hours a day just to get food on the table, and he's got pressures and whatever. And despite that fact, he learns 1 hour a day. 1 hour a day. Which one of those people is Asei Toras Chakeva? The person for whom that 1 hour a day is sacrosanct. His whole life revolves around that 1 hour. That's what we're talking about. Not again, I'm not taking away the mitzvah of Talmud Torah from the other person. You learn Torah, you get a mitzvah. It's wonderful. The more you learn, the better. But this higher level of not only learning Torah, but making it central to your life, that is something that is has to do not only with the time you put in, but your mentality. Let's turn over the page. Let's see at the bottom of the page. Again, we're not going to be able to have time to do everything, although I'm glad you have it. I guess at some point someone's going to knock on the door, and that's when we'll know the shiur's over, but we still have a few more minutes. The bottom of the page is a medrash, or a brayta, you could call it, from Avos to Rabbi Nassim. And here you have a third dimension. Not only of having a bare minimum every day, not only of making it the central value and anchor of your life, we have another point. It says, listen, see, he points us to this Avos Rabbi Nassim. What does that mean? In our Mishnah, make Torah keva, malamed, see what's underlined? Im shama adam davar mipi chacham bebeit midrash, al ya'ase oso arai, al ya'ase oso keva. Very, very intriguing, very unclear. What does that mean? Says the Braisa, if you hear something from a chacham, from a rabbi, from a scholar in the base medrash, don't take his words in a manner that's arai. Arai is the opposite of keva. Rather, take those words in a manner that's keva. What do you think that means? Now we're not talking about how much you learn, how much you don't learn, how important learning is to you, per se. When you hear something from somebody, you hear Torah from a Rav, make that keva. Don't make that arai. That's a very, very tricky kind of idea. Not only that, just if you take a look at the bottom, then the Braita quotes Ezra. How Ezra quotes Psukim from Sefer Ezra. Again, I'm sorry we don't have time to read it all inside. But how Ezra also, he learned, he taught, and he ruled, and he helped people do mitzvos. So when Rav Lichtenstein elaborates on this Braita, you turn over the page, starting at the half of the Braita, where quoted Ezra, what does Ezra have to do with this? Now if you know a little bit about Tanakh or Jewish history, you know when did Ezra live? What in a very, you know, difficult part of Jewish history, Chorban, then the rebuilding of the second Beis Hamikdash. So Rav Lichtenstein quoted another medrash, the top of the back page, the Tana de Be'eliyahu. If you have a chance to take a look at it, it paints a very poignant picture. I'll paraphrase it for you, but you can follow along on the inside if you'd like. Says the Tana de Be'eliyahu, when the Jews were leaving, I think at the time of the first destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash, when the Jews were leaving Israel, they saw Ezra, and they said to him, if a slave is freed by his master, if a slave is kicked out of his house by his master, does the slave still have responsibilities to the master? Does the slave still have the privilege of being in the home of the master? To which, of course, Ezra responded, no, obviously not. So they said, well, in that case, Hashem has kicked us out. Hashem has kicked us out of Israel. Apparently we're free now from Torah and mitzvos. To which Ezra had to respond and say, in essence, Asei Toras Chakeva. No, no, no. Namely, says Rav Lichtenstein, Keva here, in the sense of permanent, not transient. There was a sense, he says, especially in the ancient world, of religion being tied to geography. You know, if you lived in a certain place, you worshipped a certain god, Lahavdil. And if you went to a different place, a different god. In this case, it wasn't just geography going from Israel to Babylonia, to Babel. It was God having kicked them out. So there was a mentality which apparently could have festered, it could have been a disaster, which saw Torah as having been something, oh, if Hashem wants us, when Hashem has us in Israel, it's for a certain time and place. But maybe not when we're in transition, maybe not when we move to another time and place. Therefore, Ezra, this is the back part of the Braita, Keva. I don't care if you are in Israel or Bavel. I don't care if you are in London or Los Angeles. I don't care if you are in Tel Aviv or Toronto, Beit Shemesh or Boston, Alon Shvut or, well, help me out, somebody. Alliteration here.
Annapolis.
Annapolis. Okay? Or Austin, Texas. Asei Torasra Keva. Melbourne or Modi'in. Wherever you are. Transient. It's not a rye. Here today, gone tomorrow. Wherever you are, Torah is a part of your life. That was the first thing.
Would that be universal rather than permanent?
Okay, that's fine. That's the same. That's the gist. Okay? But then what about the first thing? When the rabbi tells you something, I say to Rasa Kevin, what does that mean? The Sefer Luchosim here in, by his light, page 66 or 67, says very beautifully. He says there's three types of experiences people have in life. By the way, just to clarify, is the Musar thing whatever's supposed to happen next in this room?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So I don't have to worry that you're missing something somewhere. Center of listening. There are three types of experiences that a person has. There are certain experiences that you have when you have them in the moment. They're fine, they're wonderful, they're nice. But, David, come on. I'm not in first grade anymore. We have certain experiences that when you have them in the moment, we know that they're temporary, they're transient. That's fine. Not everything in life has to be such a big deal. There are a lot of chavayot, a lot of experiences we have in life. He gives example of things you read. You read a nice article, a nice comic. It could even be, I don't know, you like politics, sports, poetry. It doesn't matter what it is. But it was good for the moment. It gave you a certain pleasure, but then you move on. Because then there's other things where, you know what? This article, this idea, this experience, I really would love to be able to hold on to this. He gave an example. I didn't put it on the sheet. But again, if you're into politics or culture, you know, there could be a certain thing. He gave an example of a commentary magazine. I don't know if that means anything to you guys. Or if you're really into sports and you're American, maybe ESPN or something. You know, you read a certain thing or you see a certain video or something and you clip it, you put it in the file. You save it, you know, on your iPhone or something, right? You know, you heard a certain, you know, lecture. You know, it's not the end of life if you forgot it. It's not going to make you break your whole life. But, you know, it touched you, it caught you. There was something there. You'd like to be able to keep that with you. That's a second level, he says. Torah is not either of those. Torah is supposed to be the third level. Look at the third line there of that sheet. But there are things, the highest level, to which a person is committed to a degree that he wants them to be a part of him. When he has that kind of experience, he wants it to be internalized and not to remain ephemeral. This is what the Braita tells us with regard to Torah. Asei Torascha Keva. See to it that it is ingrained, that it is absorbed, that it becomes a part of you. If you want something to remain with you, you must immerse yourself with it. So it's not enough just to learn a minimum amount, a regular amount. Again, now we're getting back to attitude, Austin, but a different kind of attitude. Of what is the, I'll put it the way they would say it in a yeshivish way, what is the chashivas of Torah? How important is it to you? Things that are truly, truly important are things you never want to let go of. So, getting back to that bright, when the rabbi says something that makes matters, make it keva, make it part of you. Not something that just went in one ear and out the other, and it was a nice trip on the way. But deeper than that, make it a part of you. And with this, Rav Lichtenstein comes to the last section of the essay, and he quotes a famous Gemara that I'm sure that either inside or outside, you're all familiar with, and that is the what happens when you die Gemara. Gemara Masechta Shabbos, Daf Lamed Aleph. You'll be asked a number of questions by God, by the Rabbono Shel Olam. And one of them is, Kavata Itim LaTorah. Now, if I were to paraphrase that, especially if I hadn't been listening for the last half an hour to cheer, I would paraphrase that as, did you learn Torah? I might even say, was Torah important to you? But clearly, at this point, I hope we're much more sensitive to the language now. Maybe then, even if we've seen this Gemara 5 times already. But now, all of a sudden, we're struck by the language, right? Which is, what word did the Gemara use? All of a sudden, it used the word koveya, or kavata. And Rav Lichtenstein notes this. Why would the Gemara use that word particularly? And Rav Lichtenstein points out in the next section, 67, and then he, We don't have time to see it inside, but he quoted the Rambam. The Rambam elaborates on this and talks about how important it is to have regular siddurim of learning. It doesn't matter if you're rich, if you're poor, if you're married, if you're single. It doesn't matter, you're old or you're young, you're sick or you're healthy. No matter what stage of life you are, the details might change. But the idea of kavat itim latorah always has to be. So why is that part so important? Why is the Gemara and the Rambam emphasizing the idea of kviut, set times? The Sefer Brooklyn seems so insightfully. One is obligated not just to study, but to set a fixed time for study. Why? Because when a person is kovei itim latorah, he has indicated that the Torah has a permanent place in his life. A person who enjoys playing basketball will play if he has time, but he won't if he doesn't have time. On the other hand, there are certain things you do regularly because you understand they are part of your very being. The question is, how is Torah going to fit into your life's experience? And we have to ask that question, answer that question from Hashem. It's not just did we learn? Was learning kavata itim? Was that, getting back to what we saw from Rashi at the beginning, an immovable force in your life? Again, we're not talking about how much. Maybe it was only 15 minutes a day. Maybe it was 20. Whatever it was a permanent, fixed part of your life. Torah cannot merely be a hobby. That's his example of basketball, which could have been speaking to me, because as far as all the hobbies go, that's my one true love when I was a kid, was basketball. But it could be music, it could be whatever your hobby is. That's clearly not the important point. But hobbies come, hobbies go. Hobbies are clearly secondary too. School, cleaning your room, or whatever else your mom wants you to do. Right? Those are hobbies. Torah cannot be a hobby. Now, again, it all depends on how you mean it. I met a boy on the recruiting trail, who Emir Tzashem will be here next year, who is like an unbelievable masmid. I was actually talking to his mother afterwards, after I met the boy, and I was really very impressed with the boy himself. But the mother was like, you know, she's proud, she's a Jewish mom, she's allowed. And the mother says to me, she's trying to tell me about how great her son is. And I'm nodding, I was very impressed with him, I was. She says, Rabbi, you have to understand, his hobby is learning Torah. Now, in that context, the word hobby was clearly a high compliment. Right? You have to be, you know, we have to think very carefully, right? Just in a Lichtenstein's context, the hobby is not a good word. In that context, the hobby is a very good word. Right? Here he means, if you only learn, if you only treat it as a hobby, meaning you have time, it's good, you know, I go to the club once a week, I do that once, you know, I play bridge once a week, you know, I check the horses once a week. That's what he's criticizing. Someone who learns so regularly because that's all he wants to do even in his free time, that's obviously very high level. So that's wonderful. Baruch Hashem, more of them should come. Wonderful. Okay? But this kind of thing, easy come, easy go, that is something that we're not supposed to have. We don't just make time for it. Rather, it stays with us. I just want to conclude, I'll just mention in the last minute or two, the final selections I have here, which are just from the essay itself. So first of all, he points out in the part that says 6970, that the Gemara doesn't just ask kavat itim latorah, it also asks what level of learning you had. Pilpalta, did you do the pilpule? Were you really into it? In depth, analytical? Were you maven dover mitok dover? Were you making inferences? What's that all about? So look and see, that's also a litmus test. Because to the extent that you are not just doing it in a superficial way, kind of a bekius, if you will, but really the omek, the depth, which one do you think is more likely to stick with a person? Right? There's a circular relationship, a reciprocal relationship between how deep and how invested you are in something and how much it stays with you. Right? Easy come, easy go. If you just learn things superficially, it's easier for them to leave you. But if you really invest in them, you understand a deep way, they're more likely to stay with you. The last two things he says are also unbelievably important. Page 72, he points out that this should be understood in the context, which we speak about here all the time, and when I was out, you know, recruiting, I must have mentioned to every single person I met, which is that you cannot ever, chas v'shalom, separate learning from overall religious personality. And this is the point, again, I only gave you a little paragraph, but this is all page 72 here. You can't disconnect learning from Yirat Shamayim. As he points out, every now and then you'll find a person who fancies a little learning. totally disconnected from his way of life, but he finds it interesting. He enjoys a good shiur, a good book. But he says, al pi rov, the majority of people who are going to regularly be into learning is because it's part of their overall religious persona. They want to be close to Hashem. They want to grow better themselves as a person. And one of the vehicles, one of the primary vehicles, is through the learning. But there's, again, there's a reciprocal relationship. He calls it a circular relationship between Yirat Shamayim and learning. The more Yirat Shamayim you have, the more you realize it's important to learn. And the more you learn, the more Yirat Shamayim you'll have. Chas v'Shalom never did to separate those two. And last but not least, we'll read the last paragraph just together. He points out that nothing we have said until now, and I hope I've given you, I read the book as if he was speaking to me as passionately as I'm trying to speak to you. Right? It's a very passionate, impassioned plea, this whole essay. But you shouldn't mistake his, or Lahavdil, my passion for thinking that this is just easy. On the contrary, he says, and with this we'll conclude, this, of course, is a large demand. And what is significant and striking about it is that this is a demand made of each and every Jew. One cannot allow his social setting to determine for him whether or not Torah has a place in his life. It must be clear wherever he ends up, Torah is a central value, a framework for his life, something which is inherent in his very being. This is not easy, but this is your charge. And you cannot hide behind the fact that, well, he went to yeshiva, I didn't go to yeshiva, he's a rabbi, I'm a lawyer. This is irrelevant to the conversation. The implementation, the form it will take, will clearly differ based on your experiences and your current situation. But this attitude, this mentality, this axiomatic value that Torah should have in your life as a central anchor in your life is demanding. But that's exactly what is demanded of each and every one of us. Okay, guys, yishkach, and have a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos.